Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Schema episode. Yusuf here. I'm with Mark, Noah, and Maddie. And Noah has just coming off a stretch of nights. Noah, how are you feeling?
Sleepy. I feel like Mark said, every time I go to record a podcast, it's like right after I finish nights, which makes for some very sound clinical reasoning. So I'm excited to hear for Mark's case today. What about you, Maddie? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I always like love hanging out with you guys every month. And yeah, updates. Like we were just sharing before, I had some visitors this weekend. My brother, my best friend from med school. Giving birth in a few weeks. So those are the big updates in my life. But yeah, really excited to be here with you guys. And Mark, any updates you want to share before we jump into the case?
Maddie, I love how you just snuck in and just giving birth in a couple weeks. Like just very casual, no big deal. Just going to be a new mom. It's amazing, Maddie.
I think it's probably like a cope, you know, if I say it in a nonchalant way, it'll be, you know, no big, you know, a big deal, but also like doable. So maybe that's why I'm saying it in that way.
No, thank you so much for sticking with the team and recording this podcast, even though you've, you know, given birth in a couple of weeks. That's amazing. I'm good. I have a little bit of time off before I go to India in a couple of weeks. In about 2 weeks, I'll be heading to India, see some family, which I'm really excited about. My wife's side of her family, so a lot of them live in India. So yeah, we're going to explore the northern part of India, see her family in the southern part of India. So we're going to be away for 2 weeks. So it's going to be a really nice trip. We're really excited.
That sounds awesome. We're excited to get the photos and the updates from the trip.
Yeah, so good to see you all as always. Mark, can't wait to hear your case.
Yeah, I'm super excited to present this case to you guys. So let's start off. So the first aliquot, we have our chief concern. We have a 52-year-old female who presents with 1 month of progressive left lower extremity weakness and pain. So, Yusuf, what do you think?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Interesting chief complaint, weakness and pain. Whenever I hear the word weakness, I wonder if this is a subjective weakness or is this a weakness that we're able to feel on exam? Is this weakness or is this asthenia? And oftentimes, if the patient has pain, the most common etiology is going to be joint disease and joint disease causing pain, and that's causing the patient inability to move their extremity. And that's where most weakness and pain localizes to. But the differential for weakness in general is very, very broad. You can start with the muscle, the neuromuscular junction, the nerve, and then you can go up all the way to the spinal cord and the brain. And the exam is going to be really, really helpful here. And Noah, I'm wondering, what does the qualifier of pain add to your differential for weakness? Does that change your thought process?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I think it's a very interesting first aliquot. I think if we just go by pathophysiology, right, what can hurt in your lower extremity? The skin, the dermis, the bones, the joints, the muscles, the vessels, the nerves, or maybe referred pain. And if we overlap that with what causes weakness, I think we can exclude some of those things. But I can make most of them fit, right? Like if you have muscle pain in your extremity, like you said, you can be pain limited. If you have joint pain, you can be pain limited. Or if you have a process that's affecting the nerve, you can have both nerve pain and weakness from a neurological cause. I think in this patient, what would be most helpful for me right now is understanding exactly where it hurts and understanding better the tempo of this disease. I think 1 month is kind of subacute, and those are the most interesting complaints because they can either just stay there and kind of plateau and become chronic, or they can be progressive. And 1 month is like, I have only left lower extremity pain. And then next month is the other extremity, and so forth and so forth. So understanding exactly when the symptoms begin, how do they progress, and where exactly it hurts, those would be my first questions for this patient. What do you think, Maddie?
I absolutely agree with both of you. And I think at this point, as Yusuf started us off at, like, staying pretty broad in the whole neuro axis of weakness is something I would do. And then kind of practically thinking about what are my do not miss causes for someone with weakness and pain. I think ischemia is on that list. And so I think part of my exam, in addition to what Noah, you said, and Yusuf, is thinking of pulses in this person and just like looking at the leg. Is there pallor, for example? So like an acute ischemic event, or not even acute because it's been a week, but an ischemic event is something I definitely don't want to miss. And that's kind of the only thing I would add to what you all said, but really curious to hear more, Mark.
It's awesome to see how much juice you guys got out of just two words, weakness and pain. It was very interesting to see you guys overlay those two symptoms. So let's get a little bit into the HPI. So like I mentioned, so this syndrome started about a month ago. This patient is very functional at baseline, ambulatory, walks around, no issues, and essentially 1 month prior to admission, developed acute onset pain in their thigh and calf. They didn't really think too much of it, but then they start to develop left lower extremity weakness and had three falls over the last month. And as I mentioned, prior to this, no prior history of weakness, leg weakness, arm weakness, no weakness at all, and no history of falls. She denied any trauma. And she essentially said whenever she stood up, she felt like her left lower extremity felt like jello. She denied any numbness and tingling, no bowel or bladder incontinence, and no saddle anesthesia. And she said that then 3 weeks prior to admission, so 1 week after her symptoms started, she developed postprandial abdominal pain and constipation. She denied any prior history of abdominal pain. She said prior to this, she had normal bowel movements. She denied any melena, hematochezia. And then she also said that she had a 60-pound weight loss over the last year. She said she attributed it to just her exercising more often, but she was eating the same amount of food that she typically does. But just on review systems, that's something she noted. No fevers, no chills. And then going into her background. So unfortunately, she actually hasn't seen a doctor in 20 years. So like I mentioned, she's 52 and hasn't seen a doctor since she was in her early 30s. So she has an unknown past medical history. She denied any known medical conditions. She's not on any meds and she has no known allergies. She has a sister that has rheumatoid arthritis, but denies any family history that she knows of neurological disease. In terms of social history, she lives in the Bay Area, California. She currently does not work. She denies alcohol or tobacco use. She is not sexually active. And she denies any recent travel. And that is the end of this aliquot. So Maddie, maybe we'll start with you first. What do you think about this HPI now?
Really fascinating here. So I think in my mind, I'm separating these two concerns that the patient is coming in with, and I'd probably be thinking about them separately before trying to connect them. So we have, on one hand, this postprandial abdominal pain and some weight loss. And then we also have the syndrome of, over a month-long time period, pain and then weakness. If we just think of the weakness bucket and those symptoms, so just to kind of like lay out the neural axis for true weakness, because I think, you know, we'll see on exam that this really is true weakness, but for someone who's falling and who feels like they can't, they have a deficit there, I think I'll be operating under the hypothesis this is true weakness and until proven otherwise. And so if we think of the motor pathway and what's needed for someone to walk, you start in the cortex and you have the upper motor neuron that goes from the cortex into the brainstem, into the spinal cord. And then that synapse is on the lower motor neuron. And then you have the peripheral nerve, neuromuscular junction, and muscle here. Mark said that there was no sidal anesthesia, no bowel and bladder incontinence. So that pushes me away from the spinal cord. I'm trying to think if there is a way I can really rule out the cortex here. And I think I'm still entertaining that. Like, could this still be a cortical process, like a strategic location in the cortex that's causing this unilateral weakness? I think that's absolutely still a possibility. And I think I'm also still entertaining a peripheral nerve process as well until we get more information from the physical exam. So I think the only part of the neural axis that's a little bit less likely for me is the spinal cord based on the lack of bowel, bladder, incontinence, saddle anesthesia. But I think all other localizations, the cortex, the peripheral nerve, neuromuscular junction, and muscle are still on my list. In terms of kind of layering in the postprandial component, maybe I'll pass that to Noah to see how you think about that.
That was a great discussion, Maddie. I think with postprandial pain in this background of weight loss, I am trying to understand the problem better, to understand how to connect it to the other complaints of the weakness and the pain. I think if we divide it into, you know, poor intake versus increased catabolism, if we go down the path of increased catabolism, maybe she has an inflammatory condition that's now resulting in her having pain and weakness. Or maybe she has a malignancy that's now resulting in pain and weakness, of like tumor infiltration or whatnot. If we find out that she is taking less intake that she used to take, then I'm thinking about, could this be an early sign of maybe autonomic involvement with gastroparesis? So I'd ask her, hey, you know, how big are your meals? Do you feel like you are eating less? Do you feel like you get full with just maybe like an apple? Do you think that before you're able to eat more? And I think if she answers positive, I think that's a very important clue to the mechanism of her discomfort. And one thing, just because, you know, clinical problem solvers, we love our zebras, neurological signs and then abdominal pain, like vague porphyria comes to mind. And I'm very glad that Mark already told us that, you know, family history is negative for the neurological diseases. But that's a fun one to think about. What do you think, Yusuf? How would you reconcile what Maddie and I have said?
I think the only thing that crossed my mind is when you hear pain in calf and thigh, what supplies both and causes pain? I think the only things that do that are either nerve or blood vessel. And I think if it were a stroke, it would be like more abrupt and less painful. And here we hear about pain and unilateral. And muscular diseases typically do not affect the unilateral, like extremity. So I think I'm at like, is this a nerve problem or is this a blood vessel problem? And I think I'm terrified with the weight loss. And I think we're in a EGD deficiency state at the moment, but I'm sure Mark will give us more information shortly, but no more progress than what you all mentioned. Back to you, Mark.
This is great. I think you all are going to really enjoy the exam. So we can move on to the exam. Some of the vital signs: the patient was afebrile. Their blood pressure was 109 over 70. The heart rate was 76, and they were saturating 100% on room air. Generally, they were chronically ill appearing, but in no acute distress. And I'll kind of just move right to the neurological exam. So the patient was awake, alert, and oriented to person, place, and time. Their cranial nerves 2 through 12 were intact. Their strength was 5 out of 5 in their upper extremities and 5 out of 5 in their right lower extremities. However, their strength was 2 out of 5 on left hip flexion, knee extension, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, and ankle inversion and eversion. There was also atrophy noted in her left thigh. The sensation to light touch was intact, but she had extreme allodynia in her left thigh and left calf. And she had normal reflexes in her upper extremity. She had areflexia on her left patellar reflex and had a normal reflexes in the rest of her left lower extremity. And for her abdominal exam, Her abdomen was soft, non-tender, not distended. Okay. Now moving on to the basic labs. So she had a CBC. She had a white count of 10.1 with a normal differential. She had a hemoglobin of 14.3 and a platelet count of 575. For her basic metabolic panel, she had a sodium of 134, a potassium of 4, a chloride of 97, a bicarb of 22, a BUN of 10, creatinine of 0.64, and a calcium of 9.5. In regards to her liver function tests, she had an AST of 26, an ALT of 18, a total bilirubin of 0.4, an ALK-FOS of 100, a total protein of 8.5, an albumin of 4. She also had coagulation studies with a normal PTT and INR. She had a hemoglobin A1C, which was elevated at 8.5. She had an ESR, which was elevated at 105, and a CRP, which was mildly elevated at 1.7. And then she had a CT scan of her head, which was unremarkable. That is the end of this aliquot.
This exam is making me think of neuropathy. The things that are making me think of like nerve injury include the lower motor neuron findings. We hear like reflexes are down. We hear about atrophy. We hear about allodynia. And in general, like most common neuropathies are sensory, symmetric, and distal. And most neuropathies are secondary to things like diabetes, alcohol use. And this is not your typical neuropathy. And this is where we hear about motor disruptions and allodynia, and it's unilateral in one extremity. So what am I thinking now? And I really like the acronym that I learned from Robbie that I use all the time, which is the ABCTs for atypical neuropathy. A being for AIDP, CIDP, and this bucket also includes like vasculitis and paraneoplastic disease. B for B vitamin deficiencies, C for cauda equina, and T for toxicity, i.e. from heavy metal, for example. And that's a quick checklist that I run through in most patients with atypical neuropathy, just as a quick checklist for motor disease that is atypical, and I'm localizing it to the nerve. In this case specifically, I think two things stand out to me. One is how unilateral it is. If you put that plus weight loss, I wonder, is there like a compressive neuropathy somewhere in the groin or somewhere in the abdomen that's causing all of this? That's one. And the other thing that stood out to me was the protein gap. And Noah, as you're going through residency, I'm sure you've seen many protein gaps, which is a protein minus albumin greater than 4. What is your reflex order set when you see that finding on labs?
Yeah, that's a great question. Usually, like the classic association would be with monoclonal gammopathy, that's causing elevated proteins and not affecting the albumin. But really, any hyperinflammatory state, you can have like polygammopathy, right? You have elevation of all immunoglobulins, and you can have a protein gap. I really like your comment about the location. That's kind of what's standing out to me too. It's a very strategic lesion, specifically because we also have pain in very specific spots, right? It's specifically the thigh, specifically the calf. That makes me wonder, is it like in a dermatomal distribution? And this is something I don't know off the top of my head, and I'll be like opening the chart next to the patient and then kind of following the dermatomes to see, because that could be a potential clue of where this lesion is located. I think even if this patient has a monoclonal gammopathy, even if this patient has diabetes, which they do have, even if this patient is, you know, most likely malnourished with the weight loss, I think this would be biased in stopping the investigation here and saying, oh, it's diabetic neuropathy. Oh, it's related to myeloma. Oh, it's related to malnutrition. Specifically because of the fact it's asymmetric and it's so quickly progressive, right? This person is already having muscle atrophy. This person has like severe mononeuropathy or locates to one leg, maybe radiculopathy. What do you think about the physical exam, Maddie? How would you like kind of translate that into the problem this person's having?
Yeah, great question, Noah. I think maybe I'll just take a second to summarize where we are and then I'll kind of answer that question. We have a woman in her 50s who does not have known medical history, but has not sought medical care. And she's presenting with 1 month of left lower extremity pain and weakness on a background of more subacute to chronic postprandial abdominal pain and weight loss. And she's found on exam to have a true objective weakness of the left lower extremity, both proximal and distal, associated with diminished reflexes, specifically in the patella. And workup so far has been notable for a protein gap, notably a normal CBC and CMP. And what else have we heard? I believe that's everything that stood out to me. And I think also workup most notable for an elevated A1C. So she has a history of diabetes. So that's kind of like how I'm framing this person. And I love how you both brought up this new diagnosis of diabetes with an A1C of 8.5. And I think, you know, that's very relevant when we're talking about neuropathy and postprandial abdominal pain, because as you both said, in folks with poorly controlled diabetes, you can get basically nerve damage and get gastroparesis, which is kind of a very common cause of postprandial abdominal pain in patients with diabetes. And you can also get neuropathy as a consequence of diabetes. But as you both said, this is generally not the presentation of it. Usually it's symmetric. It affects the lower extremities. And so this is not what you would expect in someone with diabetes, but you know, there can be kind of an initial association between neuropathy, postprandial abdominal pain, and diabetes. I think in terms of the physical exam, Noah, the fact that there is objective weakness, atrophy, diminished reflexes all point to concern for a lower motor neuron process. But then I think going to the abdominal pain, it sounds like I didn't hear from Mark any notable findings on the abdominal exam. And so I think I would probably dig a little bit deeper into her symptoms and asking exactly where is the pain. You could even, you know, try to like recreate her symptoms to try to understand it better. Like if she's able to swallow, maybe give her a cracker and like see what happens just to understand exactly what's so that we can better understand her symptoms. To the point of what can cause pain and wanting to make sure is this a blood vessel issue or a nerve issue? I think I would still want to do a pulses exam, especially of that left lower extremity, and just make sure we are not missing that. And to the point of what Yusuf was saying, like, could there be some compressive process that's causing this unilateral weakness and numbness? Doing just like a really thorough kind of skin exam, an exam of kind of the left lower pelvis to see if there's pain there, any palpable mass. Those are my initial thoughts. Anything else you want to add before we pass it back to Mark?
No, I love that, Maddie. I think the only thing I would add, which we didn't mention, was like Noah was saying, with the protein gap, you wonder, is this a monoclonal or polyclonal process? So usually I also, in addition to an SPEP and a Kappa Lambda, I usually get HIV and hepatitis panel. And because HIV alone can cause neuropathy, but then hepatitis can cause vasculitis. It can cause polyarteritis nodosa. It can also cause cryoglobulinemic vasculitis. So I think that's my automatic reflex. I think I'm waiting for Mark to tell us if there's like a compression or not, waiting for like potential EGD. And then if these are negative, then I will unlock my neuropathy schema further and maybe try to compare like mononeuropathy versus mononeuritis multiplex. But I think I'm holding off for now when waiting for more information.
Back to you, Mark. What an interesting case.
Yeah, let me give you guys a little more data. So in the emergency department, the patient had a CT scan of their abdomen pelvis with IV contrast because of the postprandial abdominal pain and the weight loss, which was completely normal. They also had an MRI of the brain, which was also completely normal. And then they had an MRI of their lumbar spine, and it showed slight asymmetric enhancement of the left L5 nerve root within the pelvis and symmetric hyperintensities and enhancement of the bilateral femoral nerves. And then the patient had some advanced labs. So they had a vitamin B12 and a methylmalonic acid, which was normal. They had an SPEP, a UPEP, and a kappa and lambda light chains, which was completely normal. An HIV that was negative. A complete hepatitis panel that was completely negative. A TSH, which was negative. They also had autoimmune serologies, including an ANA and a double-stranded DNA, which was negative. They had a C3 and C4, which was negative. They had ANCA serologies, which were negative. Cryoglobulinemia testing, which was negative. An RF, which was negative, and a CCP that was negative. The patient underwent a lumbar puncture that showed no evidence of pleocytosis, so no cells at all, a normal protein, and a normal glucose. And they also had cytology in their CSF, which was completely normal, it was negative. And lastly, the patient had an EMG that showed mild to moderate left lower extremity lumbar sacral plexopathy versus lumbar L1 to L4 polyradiculopathy with active denervation in the lumbar myotomes. All right, Noah, so I gave you some MRIs, some special labs, an EMG, an LP. What are you thinking now?
It's a very, very interesting problem. So we have this patient who has this background of weight loss and abdominal discomfort, now coming in for some neurological symptoms, and she was found to have some asymmetric enhancement in her lumbar region, and then bilateral femoral nerve involvement. And then we have the confirmation in the EMG that the place where the enhancement is being affected. So I think at this point we have our problem. We have a process that's causing a neurological problem that locates to the places, like you said, in the EMG. So a plexopathy versus a polyradiculopathy, asymmetric polyradiculopathy. How to make progress? So you gave us already the lumbar puncture, which was negative for malignancy, like negative for pleocytosis. This is helpful, but I am not fully satisfied with this workup, because if you have something that's more distal, you can have involvement without having positive findings. Also, cytology in CSF is not very sensitive. Sometimes you have to send multiple samples if you have like a high index of suspicion to increase the yield. I wonder if there is more imaging that we should do to investigate what this enhancement is. The CT abdomen and pelvis was helpful for any extra luminal masses. In an older woman, we have to think about GYN cancers. So I'm glad we got that, and I'm glad it's negative. With this weight loss and abdominal discomfort, I think GI cancers are also a possibility. So I would like a colonoscopy and an EGD, like Yusuf had mentioned earlier. And the reason why I'm saying that is because I think those lesions are so elegant and they're so localized, but they're also so progressive that makes me wonder if something's infiltrating those regions. I think if it was an inflammatory process, I would expect more diffuse involvement or maybe more patchy involvement. I don't know. I don't think it would be very common or expected for it to just affect those regions and then keep affecting those regions to such a severe degree. But if you imagine that a cancer cell just kind of wound up there and it's now slowly growing there, it'll be like limited to that space. That's kind of my leading hypothesis at the moment, something infiltrating the nervous system at those locations, causing her symptoms. And then that's something that's probably tied up to her background of weight loss and postprandial pain. What do you think, Maddie?
Yeah, no, I think this is a very tricky space. The problem we've now isolated is this a lesion at the level of the plexus, right? A plexopathy and the lumbar sacral plexopathy. And I think that is right now how I'm explaining what the patient's concern was, this left lower extremity pain and weakness. You know, I remember learning that actually when you have this combination of pain and weakness, while it's not specific to a plexopathy, because, you know, there are other things that can cause that, for, you know, for example, ischemia, as we've talked about, but plexopathy specifically, a clue to that is the presence of both pain and weakness, in contrast to radiculopathy. And my understanding with radiculopathy is you may have the pain there, but it's not usually weak. So my understanding is that combination of pain and weakness really helps point us to the plexus. I also remember learning that you can have a plexopathy from poorly controlled diabetes. And I would have to refresh my memory of basically why it would be unilateral in someone with diabetes, because you would think if someone just has kind of the consequences of diabetes, it wouldn't just affect one plexus. But probably practically what I would be looking up is kind of the association of diabetes and plexopathy and seeing if that could be a possible explanation for these symptoms. Yusuf, what are your thoughts?
I think first I'm a little bit puzzled as to what the etiology of this plexopathy is. No obvious answer just from what we hear so far. We don't hear about any compression, and it's not in the typical location, which is like brachial plexopathy. You hear about lumbosacral plexopathy, which is unique. And we also hear about that on the CT abdomen pelvis, we don't see any like large masses, large cancer, or any compression. So I'm wondering, what is the microscopic molecule that's causing this injury? So is it glucose, like Maddie mentioned, but could this be something more sinister? So is this like a malignancy causing infiltration of the nerves specifically? That's one thing I'm thinking of. And the other autoimmune etiologies I think of include things like Sjogren's disease, but we didn't hear about any symptoms of dry mouth or dry eyes. We heard that the hepatitis panel is negative as well, so that's helpful. In terms of hereditary plexopathies, I don't think of them presenting at age 50, but that's like a knowledge gap I would have to look up. And then, Maddie, Noah, is vasculitis off the table for you, or is that still on your differential? And I think one thing that I would do next, I think, is in like routine workup for the weight loss is like EGD. Think about that. I would get an LDH as they call it, lymphoma detecting hormone. And then we're going quickly towards a biopsy of a nerve. And if we don't find anything on the serologies, and I don't know if eventually we need to look more extensively for a malignancy somewhere, but I think I'm perplexed. I don't think I have one answer, but would love to hear your thoughts, Maddie and Noah.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Yusuf. I think perplex is a good word. I think this problem is not a common problem. And I like our differential, our collective differential. And I'm excited to hear what Mark has in store for us.
I agree with you guys. This is a very tough space, but a very interesting space. So I'm going to actually fast forward to when I met the patient. So the patient was actually discharged. I don't really know the circumstances of the discharge, but the patient was discharged. And then I actually met the patient 5 months later. So she presented again to the hospital for continued postprandial abdominal pain, PO intolerance, nausea, and continued weight loss. She lost about 100 pounds at this point. And she said that about 3 weeks before this admission, she developed the same neurological symptoms, but in the right lower extremity. So she developed pain in the thigh, pain in the calf, and then weakness in her right lower extremity. So now she has the weakness in the left lower extremity, the right lower extremity, and she's really not able to walk. She's completely wheelchair dependent. During that admission, I got a CTA of the abdomen pelvis for the continued postprandial abdominal pain to evaluate the mesenteric vessels that showed no evidence of mesenteric ischemia. She had an ESR that was 63 from that 105 5 months prior. And we consulted GI to perform an EGD for this continued chronic postprandial pain and weight loss. And the EGD was completely normal. And then given the reasons you guys talked about, I also obtained a PET scan to look for an occult malignancy. And the entire PET scan was completely normal. and this is the final aliquot before the diagnosis.
What was her A1C in the second admission?
5.3.
Okay.
She wasn't on any therapy for diabetes. So essentially went from, because of the weight loss, it went from 8.6 to 5.3. All right, Maddie. So now this syndrome has moved to now the right lower extremity. So it's a bilateral lower extremity syndrome. And then given the EGD, the PET scan, what are you thinking now?
You know, I think I was in the last aliquot, the only other data point that we had was, at least that I was thinking was that was pertinent for the workup, was diabetes with an A1C of 8.5. So I think that was my leading concern of what could be causing this plexopathy. And I think that's still a concern of mine, because something I'd be looking up is, you know, when someone has an A1C of 8.5, they clearly had elevated blood glucose for an extended period of time. So could she still have residual damage to the plexus from this diabetes? But I think the counterpoint to that is the fact that she's still having symptoms and now her A1C is 5.3 and presumably she has normal glucose. So I think that would be the gap in that argument. I think if we're trying to just identify like what is the problem we're trying to solve, how I would be stating that is this plexopathy on both sides that's causing the pain and weakness of the bilateral low extremities. And besides diabetes, I'm not entirely sure what to pin that on. I think for the postprandial abdominal pain, we haven't identified an etiology, right? We have an EGD, we have scopes that are normal, and we have ruled out kind of the intestinal ischemia hypothesis. So I'm also really not sure where I would go from here. But Yusuf, where are you at? What would you do?
Maddie, every time you say perplexed, I think perplexopathy.
Exactly. I'm perplexed by the plexus.
No, same. I think let's go back to the basics. I think one, do we have an explanation for the weight loss? So far, no. And no clear etiology, no clear malignancy. The neuropathy, there could be one thing driving both, but there could be, or one etiology driving the weight loss causing a vitamin deficiency, and the vitamin deficiency causing the severe neuropathy. So I think one thing I would do is check the B vitamin levels. We already checked B12. I think I would check B1, B3, and Mark's favorite B6 for sure. In terms of malignancies, what would you miss on a PET CT? Not a lot. You could miss maybe an intravascular lymphoma. It's very rare. You would look for cutaneous findings or CNS findings, but again, not very common. And then the other thing you would think of is a toxin. Is this patient like have any specific exposure? So I would just ask about exposures. And then things like amyloidosis, we already said that the SPEP is negative. We don't hear about any chronic inflammatory condition that can cause amyloidosis, like AL amyloidosis. I think that's where I'm at. I think I'm sending vitamin deficiencies. I'm asking about autoimmune symptoms. I'm asking about exposures. And I'll take it from there. And I think next step for me would be try to get like a nerve biopsy if we don't find any etiology. Noah, what are you thinking?
I was thinking the other way. I was thinking, you know, maybe they are connected, as in one underlying process causing both. I think we've done good job at imaging both outside of the lumen, inside the lumen, and inside the blood vessel, and we still don't have an explanation for the weight loss and for the VO intolerance. I think if we're thinking that this is a problem with the nerves, why not affecting the GI nerves as well, causing autonomic dysfunction, gastroparesis, and explaining those symptoms. I think this would be kind of like a very small Venn diagram of two problems, right? Like a plexopathy and autonomic dysfunction. And that's kind of how I'd make progress. This is not something I know off the top of my head, so I'd probably be researching, seeing if there's any like condition or any of the plexopathies that cause prominent autonomic dysfunction, and vice versa, any autonomic dysfunction from neuropathies that also present with plexopathies. I think diabetes is one that we really kind of just associate with polyneuropathy. but can have other manifestations, and gastroparesis is a very prominent feature of diabetic neuropathy. I think another one is amyloidosis and then multiple myeloma, like you said. The SPEP being negative does decrease the likelihood. Yeah, I don't know.
I like that, Noah. I like that. Like, I think, like, if let's say we do a motility study and we see an issue with the motility, I think I would be like, okay, maybe they're having a vitamin deficiency because of that as well. And whenever you said this autonomia, it made me think of like things like Lambert Eaton, for example. But again, we didn't hear about any malignancy. That's making that less likely as well. So that's where I'm at. Mark, teach us.
You guys did an amazing job. This is a really complicated case. So how this unfolded in real life is that, you know, so Yusuf, as you mentioned, he had a complete, patient had a complete vitamin panel, which showed a normal B1, B3, B6, copper. So we ruled out all vitamin deficiencies. Patient also had a heavy metal screen, which was negative. And there was a discussion about possibly doing a nerve biopsy. But unfortunately, the patient declined nerve biopsy after the EGD. So the patient was actually given a clinical diagnosis of diabetic amyotrophy or diabetic lumbar sacral radiculoplexopathy, essentially exactly what Maddie mentioned, I think almost two aliquots ago, when Noah was alluding to this aliquot. And then the pathology on the EGD showed H. pylori. So what do you guys think?
Wow, Mark, I'm so curious. How are you thinking about the plexopathy, kind of the second time she presented with the improved A1C? Can you have this kind of residual damage from longstanding diabetes, longstanding diabetes that doesn't prove even when your blood glucose improves?
That's an excellent question, Maddie. And before I dive into the answer to that, let's just take a step back and let's talk about diabetic amyotrophy. So this is an entity that I've read about before, but honestly didn't know too much about until this case. I'm excited to share what I've learned from this case with you guys. But let's take a step even further and talk about just diabetic neuropathy, right? 50% of cases of neuropathy worldwide are from diabetes. It is so, so common, right? And 20 to 40% of patients with diabetes will have neuropathy. So this is something we have to know really well. So let's just go over the buckets and different types of neuropathy that we can see with diabetes. So to start, you know, we're all probably very familiar with the most common type, this distal symmetric polyneuropathy associated with diabetes, right? It's a type that we see all the time in clinic, in the hospital. It's the type that's associated with long-standing uncontrolled diabetes. It starts in the long length-dependent nerves. So you first get symptoms in the lower extremities in the feet. So you might get numbness, tingling, which eventually turns into pain that starts in the feet and progresses up to the knees. And by the time it gets to the knees, then it starts in the hands. And this is slowly progressive. It's a subacute to chronic neuropathy, and in its late stages can lead to motor weakness. But the beginning symptoms are dominated by sensory symptoms, right? So it's by far the most common cause and subtype of diabetic neuropathy. Another common subtype that you guys probably have seen, especially in the inpatient setting, is diabetic autonomic neuropathy, right? And a common presentation we see in the inpatient setting is gastroparesis, right? When the autonomic nerves are damaged by hyperglycemia and longstanding diabetes, your stomach moves slower, right? And you get gastroparesis and you get nausea and you get vomiting. Other manifestations of diabetic autonomic neuropathy, you can get urinary retention, constipation, and even sometimes orthostatic hypotension. So these are all the classic signs of dysautonomia. Another really interesting subtype is actually a case I presented in the academy. What is called treatment-induced neuropathy of diabetes, TIND, or insulin neuritis. This occurs in patients that rapidly drop their blood sugar. So it's classic in a patient, new onset diabetes, aggressively controls their blood sugar. So say they go from an A1C of 8 to an A1C of 6 in a short amount of time. It's theorized that these rapid osmotic shifts going from a very high sugar to a low sugar causes damage to nerves. And these patients present with very painful neuropathy and also dysautonomia. So that was the case I presented in the academy. And let's get to this fourth bucket and the bucket that I presented today, diabetic amyotrophy. It's a fascinating condition. So it's actually thought to be immune mediated and an immune mediated microvasculitis of the plexus, right? So how does it present? It presents exactly how it did in this case. An acute onset, so it's a microvascular infarction. Think of it like that, almost like a stroke of the plexus. So it presents acute onset, asymmetric pain in the calf and thigh, followed by weakness, exactly how it presented in this patient. Another interesting feature of this disease is that weight loss is a universal feature of this condition. 80% of patients will have weight loss. And even the weight loss can predate the neurological symptoms. And this is poorly understood, but it's thought that because this is a microvasculitis and systemic disease, you can get weight loss as part of a systemic disease. So weight loss was, you know, a large feature of our patient's presentation. And whether that was from this diabetic amyotrophy or from the chronic postprandial pain and H. pylori, it's tough to tell. Both are probably contributing, but I just thought that was an interesting fun fact. Another thing is that these patients can have elevated inflammatory markers. So if you remember on our patient's first admission, they had an ESR of over 100. And then in the next admission, when I took care of them, their ESR was down from 100, but it was still elevated. So again, similarly to the pathophysiology of the weight loss, this is a systemic microvasculitis, so you can get systemic inflammation. And then, you know, like I mentioned, this condition starts in one limb, but then over weeks to months, goes to the other limb, just like in this patient. So pause. So like I mentioned, this condition starts asymmetrically in one limb, but then over weeks to months, it develops in the other limb, just like in our patient. So in the other limb, patients will get acute onset asymmetric pain, followed by weakness. Right. So it becomes bilateral in most patients over time. And really a natural history of this disease, it's slowly progressive over months to years. And unfortunately, the natural history is not really influenced well by blood glucose control. The damage is really done when this microvascular infarct or microvasculitis occurs. But over time, patients can regain their strength and their pain can resolve. But it does take time. It can take months to years. So back to your question, Maddie, just like TIND or insulin neuritis, a rapid drop in your A1C is associated with this condition as well.
Wow, Mark, what a phenomenal case. That was just incredible teaching. So I don't want to like say much just to like leave that teaching as you stated. But I love that you presented a bread and butter case in presentations that we don't often think of. As you said, we think of kind of the distal symmetric sensory predominant neuropathy in diabetes, but I think this is a really important different type of neuropathy that we should all know about. So thank you for presenting. And I do remember there was actually an RLR on a similar topic, so maybe we can link that in the show notes so that people have another rep on this condition we should all know more about. Yusuf, Noah, any other reflections on this?
No, yeah, I just wanted to say, Mark, thank you. I love learning about atypical presentations of common disease. Can't wait to read more.
Yeah, I think it's easier to see a horse dressed up as a zebra than a zebra. So, and another thing that I was thinking is that we can't really see what we don't know. So I wasn't aware of this condition, but thank you, Mark, for teaching us. And we'll be on the lookout for next time. And that's why I love the clinical problem solver so much, because every day we learn about a new disease or a new way that a disease can present. And I feel like, you know, we can better help our patients.
100% agree. Thank you so much, Mark.
See you guys next time.
See you next time. That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.